where our arms have become so long, we don't see what our hands are doing. So when we have no idea where our taxes are going, what they're being used for, we don't know where our consumer dollars go, and the end result is this vast scale where giant for-profit corporations are as almost like machines, you know, are in a very destructive way destroying jobs as well as the environment as well as democracy.
Lastly, Helena, I'd just like to ask if and if people can't make it to the conference this weekend up in Port Townsend, Washington, what's a good way for us to learn more about this?
You know, one of the biggest things we have to understand is that the corporate system doesn't want us to know about this, and so there's so much more happening than you would ever believe. We collect these stories and examples, and we are still amazed wherever we go at just how much is happening. So informing yourself and informing others is one of the most important things you can do. And on our website, localfutures.org, you could get a lot of information and material that you can take into your community. I do want to urge people to come along. We have reductions for students or for anyone who feels they can't afford it. So please don't hesitate because of costs. Do come and join us in Port Townsend if you can.
All right. I've been speaking with Helena Norberg-Hodge, the director of Local Futures and one of the organizers and presenters at the Economics of Happiness Conference in Port Townsend, Washington this weekend. Helena, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And the time has struck 6:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the Queer Boo Hour, featuring two back-to-back episodes of This Way Out.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/KBOO.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/KBOO radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Way Out is an international LGBTQIA radio magazine. This Way Out is a half-hour weekly show, and tonight, on the Queer Boo Hour, we'll be playing both last week's and this week's episodes. To find more stories and episodes, you can find them at thiswayout.org. And the following episode of This Way Out is from the week of October 16th, 2017.
I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
I kept Denise in the closet for decades, and it was a great feeling for me when at age 49 I was finally able to have Denise come out for good.
We really wanted to focus on William John Banks' story, that story from 1841, but recognize that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A hunt for homosexuals begins in Burundi, true confessions of a self-made woman, and a historic exhibit ropes Brits into honoring the exile. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 14th, 2017. A homophobic virus seems to be spreading in more countries. We've told you in the past few weeks about Chechnya-like purges of gay people in Azerbaijan and Egypt. Police officials in Burundi announced an official hunt for homosexuals this week in their country. Several people, including teenagers reportedly arrested simply for dancing together, have already been jailed and forced to bribe officials to gain their freedom. Those who can't afford the extortion face beatings, heavy fines that they likely also can't pay, and up to 2 years in prison. President Pierre Nkurunziza announced the enforcement of a ban on homosexuality in Burundi's penal code in 2009. And according to Human Rights Watch, Nkurunziza is responsible for a spiral of political violence and widespread human rights abuses in the East African country. The youth wing of the ruling party is said to target opponents and perceived opponents who they kill, rape, torture, forcibly disappear, or ill-treat. The government has already shut down the most prominent Burundian human rights organizations.
LGBTQ people in Indonesia have been under siege for several months through frequent police raids that have been urged on by high-level government officials and blessed by top religious authorities. Even though President Joko Widodo has denounced anti-queer discrimination and same-gender sex is not specifically illegal in Indonesia, except in Islamic law-governed Aceh province, cultural disapproval has made it virtually impossible to publicly support basic human rights for sexual and gender minorities in the world's most populous, predominantly Muslim nation. A police raid on October 6th at a sauna in Jakarta that's popular with gay men netted 58 people. The detainees include 4 men from China, 1 from Thailand, 1 from Singapore, 1 Malaysian, and 1 Dutchman. Authorities said none of the foreigners would be charged.
Human Rights Watch reported that most of the people caught up in the raid had been released by the following day. 4 men and 1 woman remain behind bars, however, and are charged with violating Indonesia's strict anti-pornography laws, which prohibit sex parties, distribution of pornography, sex with animals or corpses, and oral or anal sex by gay or straight consenting adults. 141 other people were arrested during the raid on a spa in Jakarta in May in what authorities called a sex party. 5 suspected lesbians were arrested in June, and their names and a video of the raid were shared with reporters. And 12 women were evicted from their shared home in September because neighbors believed them to be lesbians.
The United Nations Human Rights Office condemned the escalating attacks on LGBTQ people in Azerbaijan, Egypt, and Indonesia this week. UN spokesman Rupert Colville told a news conference that arresting or detaining people based on their actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity is by definition arbitrary and violates international law. In all 3 countries, he charged, authorities have alleged that those arrested were involved in sex work, although in almost all cases the accused have denied such allegations or indicated that they were coerced into confessing involvement. Colville called for those governments to drop charges based on vague or discriminatory laws and to repeal those laws.
But the rights of transgender people have advanced in Greece. Parliament passed legislation this week that allows trans people to change their legal gender without having to undergo reassignment surgery or sterilization. It also eliminates a required psychiatric diagnosis of gender identity disorder. The law covers anyone aged 17 and older. Children between the ages of 15 and 17 will also have access to the legal gender recognition process, but they'll still need to get a certificate from a medical council at Athens Children's Hospital. While LGBTQ activists generally celebrated the relaxed regulations, they noted that further progress remains. Married trans people can change their legal gender only if they divorce their partner, and the law also still blocks access to legal gender recognition for transgender refugees and migrants.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
That was candidate Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention in July 2016. Of course, he neglected to include hateful domestic ideology in his protection promises. And the administration of President Donald Trump has been actively trying to overturn virtually every LGBT rights advance made during the 8 years of Barack Obama. In recent weeks, the Justice Department began arguing in federal court that anti-LGBT bias is not outlawed under provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination based on sex. Obama-era guidelines to protect transgender students were thrown out, and honorably serving transgender service members face involuntary discharge if Trump's proposed ban is enacted. This week, the administration set its sights on queer seniors and even the rainbow flag.
The Department of Health and Human Services has withdrawn a December 2014 directive assuring that same-gender spouses are treated equally to heterosexual spouses in long-term care facilities that receive Medicare and Medicaid funds. Most nursing homes and hospitals depend on that federal assistance to stay in business. The Obama-era directive was issued after the Supreme Court's Windsor decision overturned key parts of the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013, but before the High Court struck down all state bans on marriage equality in 2015. An agency spokesperson explained that the Trump administration believes it is no longer necessary to enforce the directive since the Supreme Court issued its nationwide marriage equality ruling. Several queer rights groups noted, however, that previous Supreme Court rulings have stressed the importance of specifically naming groups who are protected from discrimination to allow a non-discrimination law to have its intended effect.
Meanwhile, the first ever raising of the rainbow flag over federal land, scheduled for October 11th, National Coming Out Day, made history, with an asterisk, and in spite of efforts by the U.S. Department of Interior to spoil the celebration by pulling out of the dedication ceremony its officials had arranged. Equality activists speculated that Trump administration officials became uncomfortable with the advance publicity of the historic day. So the rainbow flag flies adjacent to the Stonewall National Monument, but the flagpole itself is located on land owned by New York City, and it's not the part of Christopher Park that constitutes the first national monument dedicated to queer rights created by the Obama administration in 2014. Veteran activist Ann Northrup, who was scheduled to MC the dedication ceremony, blasted the Trump administration shenanigans on the weekly Gay USA TV show she co-hosts with Andy Hum.
They think we are so disgusting and so filthy that they cannot even let a little rainbow flag fly on federal land. This is the smallest of our concerns and yet so emblematic of how we are treated and how they want to continue to deprive us of any legitimacy as regular human beings.
In other news, it's now legal in the state of Mississippi for government workers and private businesses to refuse to serve LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. What critics call the most oppressive so-called religious freedom law in the United States, HB 1523, went into effect on October 10th after last-ditch efforts in federal court to delay its implementation were unsuccessful. The law spells out three underlying beliefs: that marriage is only possible between one man and one woman, that proper sexual relations occur only between married heterosexual couples, and that gender is an innate characteristic established at birth that cannot be changed. Initial reporting by local media outlets, however, predict that the actual impact of the law will be negligible, that only a handful of county clerks will refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples, and that the vast majority of businesses will not turn away queer dollars. Nevertheless, several LGBTQ legal advocacy groups are already petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court to review the constitutionality of the law.
And finally, President Trump tweeted in his late July edict proposing a ban on military service by transgender people that he arrived at that decision after consultation with my generals and military experts. Dozens of congresspeople sent a letter to Defense Secretary James Mattis this week asking for specifics. The October 10th letter was signed by 114 members of Congress, all Democrats, of course. Virginia Representative A. Donald McEachin wrote the letter and spearheaded the effort to get his colleagues to sign. We seek information to discover the proof of where and when the Pentagon advised the president that this was the best idea for our country, McEachin explained in a press release. If there is proof, then we can evaluate that. If there is no proof, then the president lied to the American people once again. Does anyone believe we'll ever see that proof?
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 14th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
You walk in the doorway and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like. And you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Britain's present meets the past, later in the program.
Whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find me a place in this world or I'd never belong, I gotta be me, I gotta be me. What else can I be but what I am?
Denise Dubois is a self-made woman, just like the title of her new coming-of-gender memoir. The book intrigued This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trakl with the same stories that first captivated the author's friends.
Starting back in 2008, 2009, sitting in the comfort of friends' living rooms in Portland, Oregon, where I reside, I would occasionally tell stories about my life as a transgender woman, things that happened to me in life. And people became so engrossed in my storytelling, they would say to me over and over again, Denise, you should really write a book. You really should write a book. And I would always go, oh, yeah, I'll write a book. I'll write a book. And I sat down in 2010 out on the North Shore of Kauai, and I started writing my book, and I wrote for the next 4 years. And when I finished, I had a manuscript of 650 pages. So, of course, the final book is nothing near that. It's 220 pages, but I was so excited to have my book published. I never expected that to happen the way it came down.
The gist of it is your journey as a trans person. And it's very adventure-filled, I must say. So, you know, maybe give people a little teaser of what they can expect to read.
My book goes back to the late 1950s when I had my first memories of being transgender at age 4, when I nearly drowned at my grandparents' lake cottage in southern Wisconsin. I was rescued. Had to wear one of my cousin's dresses when my clothes were drying. And that's when I knew that I was transgender. As soon as that dress was on me, I had this feeling. It was like just this revealing moment in my life where I felt proper and in the right role for myself. I knew that this was my future. It was a very difficult time, even at that young age, because my parents, as I began to exhibit transgender behavior, really tried to shut me down. And as a consequence, I found myself retreating deeper and deeper into a closet that was very hard to come out of, which is why it took me decades to break that routine that I'd found myself in. I had quite a male persona that I'd built up around myself all those decades. As a consequence of all that, I ended up using a lot of drugs and alcohol. I survived. I found a way to pull myself together, and I found a way to come out at age 49. 1 month shy of my 50th birthday. I went to Bangkok for my gender-affirming surgery, as it's called today. And since that time, life just opened up for me. It was such a great thing. My book does take you around the world in many different places. I tried to be as genuine and honest as I could in my book. I put it all out there is what I'm trying to say, and I didn't hold anything back. And so there's a lot of graphic language in my book of things where I found myself in very dangerous situations, and I managed to pull myself away from all that as well and survive.
Have you tapped into other trans writers?
When I first started writing my book, there were suggestions to me from others, oh, you should read this book on transgender, you should read this person's book on their story. And I kind of made an effort, a promise to myself, to stay away from reading other stories. I just wanted to write my own story.
Are there any questions that I haven't asked you, you wish people would, or things you want to say that I didn't ask?
For decades, I kept Denise in the closet. I didn't really have much of a choice in my life, and I had to do that. And it was a great feeling for me when at age 49, I was finally able to have Denise come out for good. So what was the first thing I did? I kicked Dennis in the closet for the next 12 years. And how fair was that to Dennis? Because here's the deal. Denise is always going to occupy center stage for the rest of her life. But I realized that there should always be a bit role for Dennis on that same stage. Never forget where you came from. Never forget who you are. Always be your true self. And that doesn't matter if you're transgender or not. Just be sincere in your life. Be honest with others. Care for others. Learn to love yourself so you can learn to love others. That's one of the most important lessons in life. And being able to forgive others is another great lesson to learn in life that I'm still at times struggling with, but getting there. When you find and accept yourself for who you are, you could be a much better person to others in this world. I have a terrific website. I've been interviewed from here to Poland. That's all posted on my website, so selfmadewomanbook.com. Please join me there and follow me as I travel, hopefully the globe.
I gotta be free as the breeze, just wait and see.
Self-made woman author Denise Dubois was interviewed by Dixie Trykle.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Everywhere we go,
the historical exhibit is stirring a range of emotions in the UK. This Way Out correspondent Mary Milton takes us there.
I'm at Kingston Lacey, a National Trust property in Dorset. It was the home of William John Banks until in 1841 he fled to Italy in exile in order to escape prosecution for homosexuality. Today, the National Trust are proudly flying the rainbow flag, and I know inside there's an exhibition to honour William John Banks and to tell his story. I'm here to see that and to meet the people who've designed it.
My immediate reaction walking into Kingston Lacey is, wow, you really don't mess about with the message here. I'm with Richard and Julie, who've put this exhibition together. Julie, tell me where we are and what this represents.
This is the entrance hall of Kingston Lacey. This is the beginning of the Exile Project. And you walk straight into this, what we call transitional space, where people leave and people come in, into 51 thick manila rope pieces hanging from a wooden structure. And they each represent a man who was killed under laws of the criminalisation of homosexuality at the time of William John Banks, who lived in this house. So throughout his life, 51 people, 51 men were killed under laws of the time. So,
and we've been interrupted by a voice now that's reading names.
They're the names of these 51 people, and they have been read by the staff and volunteers of Kingston Lacey in workshops that we held to include everybody who is currently in Kingston Lacey in this exhibition.
That was really important to us to have that collaboration because it makes them human. These were people who were brothers, fathers, they were family members. And when you hear the voices from men and women, young and old, living today, it hammers home that these were not just names from the past. They are people, real living people, with connections, lives and loves, and we really wanted to make that a very human story.
Shall we move in further to the exhibition? We've left the ropes, which were hugely, hugely dramatic, I have to say. Just seeing them as you come through the entrance hall, it made me think of things that are happening today as well. And you've continued that throughout the house, that theme.
Yeah, we really wanted to focus on William John Banks's story, that story from 1841, but recognise that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today. And that's something we really try and surface in this room that we're in now, which is called the Spanish Room.
This room is possibly where we feel closest to William John in this house. It is absolutely opulent, gold, and most of this came from when he was in exile. Most of these paintings, most of the leather work, the gold leather work, he sent it. He wasn't here to see this. What we're looking at are three Georgian windows that look out over his estate. The central one has been photographed and filmed to create this projection. You look through this window and the landscape changes. This is like a stage looking out to the rest of the world, and we see other people's words and experiences and locations come up, so we can get reminded that this is actually happening in other countries today.
We should say a little bit about William John Banks's story as well. So he inherited this house, and then he was caught in a compromising position with the soldier, is that correct?
Yeah, twice.
Right, okay, so there wasn't any doubt about this.
There wasn't any doubt about this story. The first time he was caught, that went to trial, and he was acquitted. And it was a few short years later when he was caught again with a guardsman in Green Park. And that time, there was a sense that he might not have been so lucky. So he didn't risk that. He didn't go to trial. He had 12 days, as I understand that, and in that time he organised his affairs and he fled.
Derek and Gordon, you didn't know the exhibition was on today,
no,
did
you? You walk in the doorway and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It's very emotive. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like, and you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah. It could have been us, couldn't
it?
It
could have been us. Yeah. But that's how it's changed.
When you come to places like this, how often do you see the LGBT story told, your story?
This is the first.
First time, yeah.
This is a first. It's a new groundbreaking.
What does it mean to you that the National Trust can do this?
Very special. And we've come on it by accident today, really. It's very nice. I've never known anything like this before, really.
51 bodies.
50, yeah.
You can see them.
We feel that it's like those people, they've lived, and yet they've been done out of their lives. In history, that 170-odd years ago, just like yesterday, really.
Drop in the ocean.
And it's not like today, is it? Because
no.
Today,
no.
Things are different.
Yeah.
Things are so different.
Yeah.
So different.
Yeah. Wasn't like that.
It just shows you how far we've come. That's from...
It. Yeah. It's amazing, is it? I mean, you guys are married now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Recently married.
Yeah,
this year.
Yeah.
On your 60th birthday, we got married, didn't we?
So those two gentlemen to come in and connect like that, they can make a connection they wouldn't have been able to have done prior to exile being on here. It's very heartwarming to see people be recognised and acknowledged, and they've taken advantage of the law to be married. And they talked about, 100 years ago they couldn't do that. It's painfully recent.
Normally you kind of do projects like this and you hear for the preview and then you leave, but the three of us, Tom, Julie and I, really wanted to stay around and see people's responses. I don't think we quite expected the power for a lot of people. There's been some very, very emotional responses we've just seen, and we've seen it from staff too. And it is blow away, really. Yeah, really, really hard hitting. You've probably seen that the whole Prejudice and Pride programme has attracted some controversy and some negativity, and it reminds us why it's really, really important to do it. And then when you hear responses like that, it's really underscores why it's important. And the National Trust's its values are very clearly stated, that to be forever for everyone, and what that means is really being there for everyone and welcoming people and enabling, like, those two guys to have the experiences that they've had.
Does that sort of reaction, does that make it worthwhile?
It does. When we started this project, I hadn't fully realised what an emotional journey it would be for us as researchers and colleagues here in the Trust. It has been extraordinarily personal at times, so that is very, very encouraging. We shall leave at the end of the day knowing that the project, at least with some people, has achieved what we really wanted it to.
The Exile installation is open every day until the 12th of November. To find out more about Kingston Lacey, go to www.nationaltrust.org.uk.
Our thanks for that report to Mary Milton. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Dixie Trackle, and Mary Milton. Ella Fitzgerald and Adam Lambert performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, KSPC Claremont, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity.
More people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections.
This is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Central Asia's anti-queer purge spreads to Tajikistan, a trans teen takes on Trump's military ban, and Australian activists rally for final yes votes in marriage equality plebiscite. Those stories and more this week, because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Tajikistan has joined the list of countries in Central Asia to launch attacks on sexual minorities. The state prosecutor's office announced this week that it had compiled a list of 367 gay and lesbian people who were put on a register due to their vulnerability in society and for their safety, and to prevent the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. The prosecutor's announcement said that 319 gay men and 48 lesbians in the former Soviet Republic were identified by federal prosecutors and the Interior Ministry as a result of what they called research into the LGBT community called Purge and Morality that began last year. No research methodology was described, however. The announcement also said that people on the list would be subject to regular medical testing for STDs, although exactly what kind of testing also wasn't specified. Any transgender people on the list were not identified as such. Tajikistan decriminalized same-gender sex in 1998 after the fall of the Soviet Union, but bias and abuse are entrenched in the mostly Muslim nation of almost 9 million people. The predominantly Russian Republic of Chechnya seems to have sparked the growing global purge of LGBTQ people in April when it began its now infamous genocidal crackdown on gay and bisexual men. Azerbaijan, another former Soviet satellite in Central Asia with a similar mostly Muslim demographic, was condemned last week by the United Nations for its recent anti-queer crackdown that has thus far netted more than 80 people. Indonesia and Egypt were also criticized by the UN for their continuing efforts to suppress LGBTQ people through routine police raids on suspected gay gatherings.
A bill that's one step away from being made law in the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan will ban propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, a near duplicate of the notorious No Promo Homo statute in Russia that outlaws any public support for sexual and gender variant minorities. The government has already pressured the landlord of the country's only nightclub that regularly hosted LGBT people to shut it down. London, located on the outskirts of the capital city of Bishkek, had been a Saturday night tradition for LGBT people for several years. According to Labrys, one of Kyrgyzstan's leading LGBT rights groups, the increasingly hostile environment in the country has led to a threefold spike in reported anti-queer attacks. Bishkek's reputation as one of the most progressive cities in Central Asia began to evaporate in 2014 when the government launched a series of reforms aimed at reversing years of steadily increasing pro-Western values. Kyrgyzstan's No Promo Homo Bill is awaiting its third and final reading.
The Central South American country of Paraguay issued its own No Promo Homo edict this week. The Ministry of Education ordered public schools to stop using materials to teach what it called gender ideology and to instead focus on traditional values and the supremacy of the traditional family. Saying that gender is a problematic social construct, Education Minister Enrique Riera also promised to burn any books that propagate gender ideology. Somos Gay, a Paraguayan LGBTQ advocacy organization, charged that the term gender ideology was invented by conservative groups to keep justifying violence and discrimination against women and LGBTI people.
No one in Morocco seems to recognize the irony of the North African nation's human rights minister calling gay people scum. Mustafa Ramid used the insulting Arabic word asak, which translates to trash, dirt, or scum, when asked by a reporter at a conference last month about the treatment of LGBT people in his country. He stood by his remarks this week on Facebook, calling homosexuality a perversion that disgusts the public opinion. He claimed that he wasn't against homosexual people, just opposed to how they make love. Homosexual acts are a criminal offense in Morocco. The country's Association of Human Rights and the Association for the Fight Against AIDS were among several national groups to charge that Ramid's words encourage homophobia, and in a government complaint called them flagrant violations of the Moroccan Constitution, which in its preamble adopts the commitment of the Moroccan state to human rights as recognized internationally. This is not the first time Ramid has made controversial remarks about lesbians and gay men. He said during a 2015 radio interview that homosexuals should have a sex change if they want to obey the law.
But, to mix metaphors, there may finally be a light at the end of the bathroom stall in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper announced a proposed settlement this week with the American Civil Liberties Union and their transgender plaintiffs who sued the state over the original so-called bathroom bill, HB2, and then its so-called compromise replacement, HB 142. The ersatz fix still makes it difficult for trans people to use the restroom or other sex-segregated public facilities that match their gender identity, and prohibits local jurisdictions from passing ordinances to protect their LGBT residents from discrimination. The settlement still needs to be approved by the federal judge overseeing the lawsuit. The state's well-publicized bias has cost it several million dollars in lost tourist income and prompted boycotts by entertainers, professional and collegiate sports associations, and businesses and philanthropic groups. Leaders of both chambers of the state legislature, dominated by Republicans, accused the governor of violating the agreement he reached with them that led to passage of HB 142 earlier this year. But Governor Cooper told reporters that he was anxious to put the bathroom controversy in the state's rearview mirror. He also announced an executive order prohibiting cabinet-level departments under his control, including their contractors, from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The governor's office said the order would affect 55,000 state employees and 3,000 vendors for up to $1.5 billion in contracts. "My ultimate goal," he told reporters, "is a statewide non-discrimination law with broad protections, and I will keep striving for it." Trans man Joaquin Carsano, the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, described the agreement as an important step for LGBT rights in the state. "Nothing can make up for the cruel and senseless attacks transgender people have faced in North Carolina," he said. "But I am hopeful that the court will agree to clarify the law so that we can live our lives in less fear." The state university system and legislative leaders, also defendants in the case, didn't sign the proposed consent decree and could file a legal challenge if the judge approves it.
And finally, political pundits and queer rights activists will be following the election returns this November of a U.S. state legislative race. Local campaigns generally don't attract this much national attention, but this one, in the state of Virginia, pits a longtime far-right Republican incumbent with a lengthy anti-queer record, including being the lead sponsor of a failed bathroom bill there, and his transgender Democratic challenger. If she succeeds in unseating Delegate Bob Marshall, Danica Rome would become the first transgender state lawmaker in U.S. history. Marshall has held his seat for 26 years. In an interview in September with a conservative talk radio show host, he insultingly referred to his 33-year-old challenger only by her first name and said that Danica clearly is out here to show that you can engage in this behavior, which clearly goes against the laws of nature and nature's God, and hold public office to make decisions on behalf of the common good. That is what is kind of at stake here, he said. Rome says her many years working as a newspaper reporter in the region have made her uniquely informed to tackle local issues. She also hasn't shied away from talking about her gender identity, saying she wants to be a role model for LGBT young people. Dawn Shaw, a local Democratic leader in Prince William County, which is an outlying suburb of Washington, D.C., thinks voters are ready for a change after so many years of Marshall's hardline conservative politics and blatant anti-queer bigotry. He noted that Hillary Clinton carried the district last November by a 54-40% margin over Donald Trump. The former reality show star has become such a political pariah as president that few Republican candidates are asking him to campaign locally on their behalf, or even for his simple endorsement. To quote the alleged moron-in-chief,
"It's a little bit sad."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government.
All those fears about the sky falling, all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
It's the plebiscite's final push down under later in the program. But first... Should I stay or should I go? Fallout from the gut-wrenching move to ban trans people from the U.S. military is spreading, and queer youth from the outcasting crew are feeling it.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Nisia, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Quinn talks about President Trump's decision to ban transgender people from serving in the military. For reasons of privacy, Quinn preferred not to have his voice heard, so Outcaster Max tells the story.
On July 26, 2017, President Donald Trump announced on his Twitter account that after consulting with his generals, he decided that transgender individuals would not be allowed to serve in the military in any capacity. To back up this decision, Trump cited the tremendous costs involved in providing medical care and services for transgender people. However, a number of published studies completely debunked this claim. The RAND Corporation did a study that was commissioned by the Pentagon. It determined that the actual cost of healthcare for all of the transgender people in the military is between $2 and $8 million annually. That's just 0.13% of the military's healthcare budget. Let's put that into further perspective. The Military Times found that the military spends approximately $84 million per year on Viagra, 10 to 40 times as much as care for transgender service members. So cost isn't the real issue. It's clear that the president's decision to ban transgender people from the military is a bone he's throwing to his base, a blatant attempt to violate and disrupt the rights of transgender people in America, hidden under the guise of improving the effectiveness of the military. The military has the largest budget of any American government program by far, with well over 1 million active members. The idea that a few thousand individuals could cause such a disruption that they'd need to be banned is preposterous. I'm transgender, and I was devastated when I heard this news. It made me feel like there was something wrong with me, causing me to be incapable of protecting my own country. When I vocalized my thoughts about this to my family, they shut me down and justified Trump's decision, saying that it's because being trans is a mental illness. Since Trump announced the ban, he has received widespread criticism, including from members of his own administration. According to an article posted on newnownext.com, Senator John McCain stated, "When less than 1% of Americans are volunteering to join the military, we should welcome all those who are willing and able to serve our country." McCain supports a bipartisan bill to block the ban, along with several other members of Congress. As of now, Trump is asking the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security to study the logistics of the ban so that it can take effect in February of 2018. The Department of Defense released an interim guidance document that outlined the temporary plan until February. In it, the department stated that new transgender individuals wouldn't be admitted as they did not meet medical standards. It further stated that after March 22, 2018, no gender-confirming surgeries will be provided for service members. Current members will not be ousted for being transgender. Trans members whose time in the military ends will be allowed to re-enlist, at least until the official plan takes effect. Whether these procedures will remain as they are is uncertain. The ban is still subject to much change, because Trump stated that he could be persuaded that a change to this policy is warranted. Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity. Although it's clear to me that being transgender makes me no less capable than others, I still feel belittled by my own president and government.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out. October the 21st. We're a couple of weeks away from the result.
This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay was on the scene in Sydney for his hometown's Get Out the Vote Marriage Equality Rally, just one of the huge Yes campaign events held in major cities across Australia over the weekend. Among the 15,000 supporters there to inspire people who still have not mailed back their ballots in the non-binding, non-compulsory postal plebiscite, Barry spoke with three key activists, starting with South Australia Green Party Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
What do you think are the priorities now to win this?
Well, there are still 4 million votes that haven't been cast, but then it's going to be a battle in the parliament, and that's where a strong yes vote is really going to matter. Politicians back in Canberra, my colleagues are going to have to do the right thing. I think the yes vote will get through. We now need to make sure a bill passes the parliament.
What things are you expecting are going to be problematic in parliament?
Well, there is, of course, pushback already about what type of religious protections and exemptions should be included. The reality is the majority of the parliament has already agreed to those things. Churches won't be forced to marry people that they don't want to. There's no suggestion that any of that would change. I think the No campaign are desperate to derail, but I don't think they're going to win.
Ireland was the first country to open civil marriage to same-gender couples through a popular vote, and Tiernan Brady brought what he learned in the campaign there to help lead the Yes forces in Australia.
Do we know what the percentage of ballots returned is at the moment?
Well, the current percentage returned is about 68%, which is a phenomenal response. It means we're probably on target for a 70-75% turnout, you know, which means more people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections. So that's a sign of how serious people are taking this and how important they realize it is. This is a vote about real people's lives and their dignity and whether the law should treat them equally. And I'm hopeful that the large turnout's a really positive sign.
Things are looking up though, aren't they?
I think the yes side have definitely won the argument, but we have to make sure that the result reflects that. And that's about getting the turnout as high as it possibly can go. I think the real story of this though is, you know, there's a million people out there who are just telling their stories, you know, standing up with great dignity, you know, and respect. And they're winning the hearts and minds of Australia, you know, and when we look back on this, hopefully we see that they were the people that changed everything.
Kat Rose of the group Community Action Against Homophobia was one of the rally organizers.
We have two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government, because we know that we've won popular support in Australia. We have for a long time, and now that support has become active in a really overwhelming way. But still, there are a lot of people in government who are determined to stop equality from passing in a meaningful way. So we need to make sure that what's passed is real equality and that they don't sneak some other discriminatory laws back in some other way.
This Way Out's Barry McKay picked up those interviews at Sydney's October 21st Marriage Equality Rally. November 7th is the deadline for ballots to be received by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is conducting the postal plebiscite. The results will be announced on November 15th. Then, as several queer activists have noted, the real work will begin, maneuvering a marriage equality bill without crippling exemptions through Parliament.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these.
The progression and treatment of that disease is the subject of a book edited by Macquarie University professor and Sydney Pride History Group president Shirlene Robinson called Homophobia, an Australian History. She talked with our Barry McKay about the past and the plebiscite.
Australia, I think, like a lot of countries, unfortunately, does have a history of treating LGBTIQ people quite badly until quite recently. It actually wasn't until 1997 that Tasmania became the last part of Australia to decriminalise sex between men. And certainly I think for people in the 1950s and the 1960s, whether they were men who feared perhaps being arrested by the police for just their own personal behaviour, or whether it was women who had to live a life of secrecy just because of who they loved, there is unfortunately a history of people experiencing homophobia and discrimination that did continue, I think, in a lot of our history.
I asked Shirlene Robinson how the history of homophobia in this country ties in with Australia being a late bloomer when it comes to the introduction of marriage equality.
Well, Australia is a very unique country in a sense, because there is more support for marriage equality here than there has been in a lot of countries that have already passed marriage equality. So you could say that a lot of prejudices that were once unfortunately held quite strongly have been eradicated. And that's not to say that there are not still people who have experienced homophobia and transphobia, but I think that we have come a long way. I think that one of the barriers in Australia has been that politicians haven't really reflected the will of the Australian people. There are some politicians who have said that they do believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, that their views are very deeply held and that they won't change those views. But we have also seen other politicians think through this issue and evolve on this particular issue. So, for example, we have a situation where actually leaders on both sides of Australian politics say that they support marriage equality. So we don't have to have a postal survey, but for reasons of internal politics, we find ourselves in this situation.
I further asked Shirlene Robinson if she thought there was any political capital in espousing homophobic views publicly, such as members of the far right of the current government are doing in the marriage equality debate.
I think that there was certainly a time in Australian history when expressing homophobic views would have brought you political capital. So, for example, I grew up in Queensland in the 1980s, and we had a premier who was known for his terrible homophobia. When HIV and AIDS came to Queensland, the way that he would talk about people who were gay or people who were living with HIV and AIDS was just absolutely appalling. But I believe now that there may be small, very small pockets of prejudice. Unfortunately, we can't say that we've eradicated racism as much as I would like to think that we have, but we have come a long way. Obviously there are still small pockets of people who may perhaps have prejudices. If you look at the movement for marriage equality, this is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters, because they really kept this going and drove this when politicians didn't really talk about it.
So in Australia, there's a different legal framework to the United States, where there's a Bill of Rights. How does that affect issues such as marriage equality?
When the Supreme Court in the United States ruled on marriage equality, they were able to draw from their constitution, which talked about individual liberties and rights. Because we don't have a Bill of Rights here, that means that really the only way to resolve marriage equality in this country is to have that vote in Parliament.
Looking at Canada and New Zealand, two other, I guess, Commonwealth countries with very similar histories to Australia, how were they able to manage marriage equality way before we were?
For Canada, it sort of it did happen quite quickly, and it's one of their proud reforms, I think, is that they do have that very proud international early history, and they had a more of a human rights framework that they were able to draw from, sort of protections that we don't have in Australia exist in Canada. New Zealand had a wonderful achievement when it ushered in marriage equality, and I think that they were really fortunate in that Louisa Wall put a bill into a hat, essentially. You know, things are drawn out at random, and that bill was drawn out of the hat, and it was able to move onto the floor of Parliament, and it was able to be passed. And in Australia, the process of getting a bill onto the floor of Parliament can be, we don't have that sort of random element to it.
In New Zealand, a Christian fundamentalist was saying, you know, the world was going to fall apart and so forth. I mean, that's similar to what, you know, what we're hearing here in Australia. What sort of parallels are there on those fronts between what happened in New Zealand and in Australia?
Well, I think that you'll always have have fringes, extremist fringes, and I think one of the most satisfying things about seeing marriage equality happen in New Zealand has been that you've been able to see that the overall outcome has just been that more happy same-sex couples are able to have their relationships and their love recognised, and that all those fears about the sky falling and so on just haven't come to fruition. So, of course, in Australia there will be people on the fringes who will say these things, and I'm very much hoping that we can show them that there is nothing to fear and that all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
With thanks to Shirlene Robinson from Macquarie University in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. I feel fine.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Steve Pride, the Outcasting Queer Youth Radio Crew, produced by Mark Sophos, and from Barry McKay. Carly Simon, Chumbawamba, and REM performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKLU Sudbury, Ontario, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, WHAV, Haverville.